The following Dharma talk was recorded in February 2014 in Kansas City, Kansas. It is one of eight recordings from the retreat called Awakening with Insight, Cultivating Concentration and Mindfulness, taught by Shyla Catherine and Phil Jones. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Shyla Catherine is the founder of Insight Meditation South Bay in Mountain View, California. She has practiced meditation since 1980 with more than 8 years of accumulated silent retreat experience. Shyla has authored two books, Focused and Fearless, A Meditator's Guide to States of Deep Joy, Calm, and Clarity, and Wisdom Wide and Deep, A Practical Handbook for Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. Find out more about Shyla at www.imsb.org. Phil Jones has been teaching insight meditation since 1996. He has studied with teachers from Spirit Rock and the Insight Meditation Society, and graduated from the first Community Dharma Leader Program in 2000. Phil has served on Mid-America Dharma's Board of Directors since the mid-1990s. Find out more about Phil at www.silentmindopenheart.org.
Did anyone have any distractions today? Any distracting thoughts? Anything that distracted you from your meditation object? A few. Okay. What about, did anybody have the experience of only thinking what you wanted to think and not thinking any thought that you didn't want to think? No? Did you actually have thoughts that you didn't want to think? Isn't that weird that we have thoughts that even we don't want to think? I mean, when you wonder how the mind, when you think about how the mind works, it's really quite amazing that we often think thoughts that we don't even want to be thinking. What's that about? So tonight I want to speak about working with distracting thoughts. Because actually it's the distracting thoughts that are the nightmare for most meditators. Okay, back pain, knee pain might be a close runner-up. But maybe distracting thoughts really wins the prize. I think we're lucky that thoughts are invisible and that they're silent. Because imagine if all of your thoughts took form or were vocalized, how insane this room would be. It would be total chaos. But unfortunately, our thoughts are not always playful and innocuous. And although they're invisible, they tend to exert an immense influence over our moods, over our lives, over our health, our energy, our emotions. They tend to constrain or determine our abilities, affect our relationships, and skew our perceptions. So much of our suffering or unsatisfactoriness, our discontent with life, dukkha, is caused simply by the way we think. But our thoughts, a necessary obstacle? Actually, they're a rather interesting obstacle because when we look at them, we have to first ask, what are they? What is a thought? Can you even find one? Can you hold it? Can you touch it? Can you locate it? Does it have color? Does it have shape? Does it have any existence? They're quite elusive, actually. We call them slippery sometimes. But they're elusive because they're only immaterial phenomena, just momentary immaterial mental phenomena. They arise, what? As concepts in our own minds. They have no other existence outside of this momentary blip within our minds. They sometimes seem to make an incredible mess, but it's a mess that we can't just mop up or sweep up with the broom. We can't catch them in a net or imprison them in a jail. They're unaffected by the various disinfectants, palliatives, and antibiotic treatments that we use to eradicate so many other things that irritate us, that agitate or irritate or contaminate the body or our homes. We can't even remove them with surgery. Go to a neurosurgeon and say, please take out those thoughts I don't like. In the Middle Length Discourses, there's a discourse titled Two Kinds of Thoughts, where the Buddha divided thoughts into two classes. In the first category, there were thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. These are basically called akusala, unwholesome thoughts. Sometimes akusala is translated as unbeneficial, unprofitable, or unskillful. And then there are wholesome thoughts, kusala thoughts, thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will or loving kindness, and thoughts of non-cruelty or compassion. Whenever any thought arises, the Buddha says one should consider which the thought is. Is it kusala or is it akusala? Which category would you put it in if you had to put it in one of these two categories? Basically, he's asking us to consider, is it skillful or unskillful? Is it wholesome or unwholesome? Is it something that should be encouraged and cultivated and entertained, or is it something that should be abandoned, let go of, starved of its fuel? In this discourse, the Buddha said, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he has abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will or thoughts of cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of non-ill will, loving kindness, or non-cruelty, compassion, to cultivate the thought of ill will or cruelty. And then his mind inclines to those thoughts. And then the sutta goes through all the various options, choosing to abandon the thoughts that lead to harm. It's an interesting question because it asks us to regularly make a choice as to what we entertain within our own mind. To what extent do you feel you have a choice about what you think? Or to what extent do you feel like you are a slave to the thought or at the mercy of the mental conditioning, of the mental patterning? Do you feel like you have a choice? Then interestingly, the sutta addresses each of the wholesome thoughts, and he says, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to Nibbana. So a wholesome thought arose. And by the way, he follows exactly the same pattern with a thought of loving kindness and a thought of compassion. So a wholesome thought arose. It was recognized. And then he realized that it does not cause trouble. In fact, it supports the progress on the path. But he thought further, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a day and a night, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. So he sees the thought. He recognizes it's wholesome. He recognizes that if he continues to think it, no harm will come. There is nothing bad about this thought. It's not going to lead to any problem in the world. It's a wholesome thought. And yet, it will tire him. It will take his energy. And so he said, so I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. This is an interesting progression because it moves from the coarse level of abandoning the unwholesome thoughts to cultivating the wholesome ones, realizing that the wholesome ones are wholesome, but they still agitate the mind and disturb the mind because they require energy to be sustained, and they are far from concentration. So even the wholesome thoughts he abandons in order to develop the deep stillness of a concentrated mind. So this first step is really important, to recognize the unwholesome ones and then to shift towards the wholesome, to realize that there is nothing to fear in wholesome thoughts, but we can still make another choice, a subtle choice, a choice to incline towards a stillness and a calmness and a quietness of mind. Because even those wholesome thoughts entangle the mind and obstruct concentration. We might often find when we're meditating that the thoughts that we're preoccupied with are not really huge hindrances. Okay, a scenario of revenge is really an obvious hindrance. Or a real strong lustful fantasy is also a really strong obvious hindrance. But you might find that your minds are not going to such coarse, unwholesome thoughts, and instead they're just circling around little obsessions, obsessions with our own stories, our own plans, trying to solve some problem, basically preoccupied with the issues of our own lives, sometimes wanting to improve, sometimes wanting to respond wisely, but we keep thinking again and again about it. In the midst of this obsession, even with relatively innocuous thoughts, we might find that we really would prefer a still mind, a quiet mind. And so when we come on retreat, we often come with the intention to cultivate this stillness, silence, this calmness and peace in our meditation. But nevertheless, we sit down with the best of intentions. And what happens? We think. Instead of trying to fight our thoughts away or hate ourselves just because we think so much, I encourage you to bring mindfulness and wisdom to the thinking process, to consider how it is you relate to your thoughts. Every meditator must develop a friendly relationship with their own mind. In the Udana, the Buddha said, not understanding thoughts, one runs back and forth with wandering mind. Do we understand our thoughts? Have we taken the time to see how they operate? What kinds of thoughts occupied you today? Which ones caught your fancy? Which ones repeated? Were they planning thoughts, planning for the future? Were they planning your meditations? Were they planning your awakening, those seductive spiritual thoughts? Were you remembering things from the past? Were you trying to fix something? I've had people come on retreats and spend hours and hours and hours sitting perfectly still, but really designing a new bench or a new way to sew a cushion or the kind of the perfect meditation gear, trying to fix something. Trying to design something away. Has your mind been preoccupied by judging or criticism? Have there been a multitude of thoughts, of thought forms and thought content and stories? Or has there really been one obsessive pattern or one obsessive story that has dominated your mind? Maybe there's one obsessive pattern. Maybe there's a flurry of trivial thoughts, a replaying of old movies, a rehearsing of conversations that you'll probably never actually have. It can sometimes be interesting to sign up for an interview because your concentration was going so well. But then after you sign up for the interview, you spend the next two meditations thinking about what you're going to say in the interview. So then what happened to your concentration? It's interesting how the slightest thing can sometimes be gripped by the mind and becomes a food for thought. Now, sometimes it's just one or two thoughts that repeat themselves again and again and again, and it can get quite boring, actually. I was sitting one retreat, and there was, and my mind was relatively quiet, but there was one thought that just could not settle. I mean, it was like a broken record. I was so bored by it. And I went to my teacher and I said, oh, this thought, it's driving me crazy. It was Joseph. Phil and I have both mentioned him, one of our teachers. And Joseph Goldstein said, don't be averse to the thought. Or he said, don't be averse to that thought. Because if it's not one thing, it'll be another. And it's so true. If it's not one thing, it's going to be another. If you don't like the hindrance that you have, what would you prefer, a different one? Do you actually want to take somebody else's hindrance? If it's not one thought, it'll be another. If it's not one thing, it'll be another. We just deal with whatever it is that we have. But then he went on to expound three very practical points that I found quite useful and easy to apply. The first was he reminded me that the content is utterly irrelevant. And sometimes we forget that when it's our own thoughts, because most of our thoughts are about ourselves, and we don't tend to like to think that they're so irrelevant. But I assure you, the content of the thought is utterly irrelevant in meditation. It's just a thought. And then he said, to watch the mind and to trace the root of desire. Because there was something in that thought that I was being enchanted by. Imagine a fisherman who puts a bait on a hook and tosses the hook into the river to catch a fish. Now the unwise fish will grasp a hold of that hook, seeing the bait, being enchanted by it, being attracted by it, and not seeing the danger in the hook. And so we have to look at what it is we are enchanted by and attracted to, what we are desiring, and see if there is a hook in that, and ask ourselves why we are chomping on that. Why are we biting that hook? And then he said, do long retreats. They're humbling. And they are indeed, aren't they? Even just a few days into the retreat, no doubt you've had a humbling experience now or then. Just seeing how little control we have over our own minds is humbling. Now, that was Joseph's advice, very practical. The Buddha had advice too on the subject. In the Middle Length Discourses, discourse number 20, the Buddha suggested five ways of working with obsessive thinking and removing distracting thoughts. These are five ways to intervene with an obsessive thought process. Basically, the thoughts that keep you from staying steady on your meditation object. You sit down, you want to focus on the breath, for example. Okay, fair enough. You sit down, you focus on the breath. So what thought pulled you away? How do you work with the thoughts that pull you away, especially if thoughts keep pulling you away from your meditation object? So the setting of this discourse is that a practitioner had taken up a meditation subject. It doesn't say which one it is, but imagine, for example, it's the breath, since that's what most of us are using. Could be loving kindness. It could have been another meditation subject. And then his intention is to develop concentration, to bring the mind to that meditation subject. And yet as he's doing so, it's said that his mind is assailed by evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion. Have you felt your mind assailed at any point today? Basically, even though this sounds very strong, most of our thoughts would probably fall into one of these categories. And so then it goes through five different strategies, and they're sequential, starting with the lighter ones. So we kind of try the easier ones first. And his first suggestion was to shift attention to a wholesome thought, a positive thought. This is antidote practice in a way. Basically, an unwholesome thought arises, so you replace it with a better one. An example of that would be if you have a thought of ill will or anger or hatred, you shift your attention to loving kindness. If you have a thought of anger or cruelty, you shift it to compassion, to see the suffering of being. It's just a gentle shift of intention, of way of seeing things, that can cut through the stories that could proliferate in anger or hate. But a more common shift in thought is the application of the thought of our meditation object. I spoke yesterday about the factor of vitakka, the initial application of the mind to the meditation object, that directing of attention. It's a thought. We have to think of the meditation object. It's a form of thinking, a subtle, refined form of thinking, but nevertheless, it's a thought of our meditation object. And so basically, we return our attention to the present experience of sitting and breathing anytime we find our attention has wandered off. We let go of the distracting thought and replace it with the thought of our meditation object. We come back to the breath. We might replace restlessness with the steadiness of attention. We might replace desire with an intention to let go of renunciation, of contentment with what is, contentment with little. And the simile that he gives is of a carpenter who knocks out a larger peg with the smaller peg. And you can imagine that there's like a block of wood with a peg in it, and he takes one peg and then pounds on it with another peg. So he gets rid of the big peg, but then the little peg doesn't get stuck there because it's just a little peg. I think we all do that, right? You've all come back to your breath at some point in this retreat. Oh, good. I'm glad to see lots of nods. Now, the second suggestion, he says, is if you were replacing those thoughts with more skillful thoughts, but even while doing that, the mind is still overcome with thoughts of lust, hate, and delusion, then he has strategy number two. He says, then examine the danger in those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible. They result in suffering. Now, I don't suggest heavy-duty self-judging here. But we do need to see the danger of our of unwholesome thought patterns and actually recognize the danger that we bring ourselves into. It's a reflective investigation so that we ask ourselves, where is this thought leading? Is this increasing suffering or is this decreasing suffering? Is this what I want to be developing in my life? Is this the path I want to go down? So we reflect on the thoughts and to see how they relate to dukkha, to suffering. And the image that's given is of a beautiful boy or girl who's fond of ornaments. That boy or girl would be horrified to hang the carcass of a snake, dog, or human being around their necks. So too would one, after reflecting wisely, not choose to hang a thought of lust, ill will, or delusion around one's mind. It's quite an image, isn't it? If we think of what we adorn our minds with, we might be indeed humiliated. We might indeed think that some of our thoughts are reprehensible. One of the first insights that insight meditators have is into the nature of thought, to recognize how little control over the mind we might have, how so many thoughts arise, and to see how those thoughts often sabotage us and lead us away from our goals. I think most people who don't meditate, most people who have not looked into their mind, assume that their thoughts are true and supportive. But I think most people who sat quietly and looked into their mind are somewhat horrified. This is a good thing. We have to be willing to look. When we see the danger in the thoughts, when we see that some thoughts that we entertain are actually cultivating the very things we don't want in our lives, then it shows us the reason for developing calmness and clarity, for developing mindfulness and concentration and wisdom. Seeing the danger in distraction, we discover the benefits of concentration. Seeing the danger in unwholesome states, we recognize the benefit in wholesome states. And then we can make the wise choice. We can determine what is actually going to be better for us, what is going to lead us toward awakening. Now, the third strategy that the Buddha offered was, he said, okay, you've been replacing unwholesome thoughts with wholesome thoughts. Then you tried examining the danger in them. But while you were examining the danger in them, nevertheless, thoughts of lust, hate, and delusion still crept in. So what do you do? He said, try to forget those thoughts and do not give attention to them. Now, this may sound like, yeah, don't we wish? Try to forget those thoughts. But in a way, this is narrowing the field to deepen the concentration by saying, I'm going to give exclusive attention just to the breath. For example, I'm going to restrict the focus and not give attention to those other thoughts, not indulge them at all. I'm going to now count the breaths. I'm going to put all my energy, all my focus, all my interest into my meditation subject. I'm going to turn away from the preoccupation with all those other thoughts and just refuse to be pulled into that vortex of thinking. And he said, it's just like a sighted person can shut their eyes or look away. We have the capacity to think, but we don't need to dive in to the thinking. Just because we have a capacity to see doesn't mean we can't close our eyes and turn away. Just because we have the capacity to think doesn't mean we have to do it. We can turn our energy and focus on our meditation object. But somebody might be doing this, trying to forget those thoughts, and still those niggly little thoughts of lust, hate, and delusion keep re-arising. And then he says one should give attention to the stilling of the thought formations of those thoughts. Any clue what that means? Give attention to the stilling of the thought formations of those thoughts. This describes a progressive settling and a refinement of the mind, and it's accomplished by inquiring into the cause of the thoughts. What's the condition or the root of those thoughts? It basically is an approach to restless thinking, to distracting thoughts, by asking, why am I thinking this? What is the cause for this thought to arise? For example, if there's a lustful fantasy, instead of after we've gone through these other things and we're still having that lustful fantasy, we can ask, why am I having this lustful fantasy? What's the root of it? And immediately we'll see the underlying tendency to lust, to desire, to greed there. And so now we're working not with the content of the thought and not even with the thought itself. We've let go of all those. We're just working with this root tendency of greed or of lust or of desire. So we ask ourselves that important question. What is feeding this thought? What is the cause of this thought? It's an inquiry step. We ask the question. We investigate. And often what we'll see a cycle of a way that thoughts and emotions feed each other and fuel each other. And there might be some emotions, there might be some tendencies, there might be something underneath the repeated thoughts that need to be recognized, that need to be understood, and that need to be worked with skillfully. Often what we'll notice is simply habitual, unwise attention. You know, not some big dramatic thing, but just unwise attention. We're applying our attention in a way that keeps stimulating unwholesome thoughts rather than wholesome ones. We haven't penetrated the experience to see what it is. And so with this stage of abandoning distracting thoughts, we're asked to refine our understanding of the underlying causes so that the calmness settles down to the roots of desire, aversion, and ignorance. And as we settle down into the roots and we free ourselves and abandon some of the tightness around those roots, we might find that the thought formations are subtler. We might find that instead of extreme agitation, it's just subtle restlessness. Instead of incredible arrogance, it's a subtler conceit. Instead of desperate lust, it's just a subtle craving, a desire for something, for some stimulus. Instead of incredible hatred, or it's just a little dislike. This stage goes through a stilling, a progressive process, because each time we ask, what is the cause for this? We explore that, and then we say, oh, but then what is the cause for that? Oh, and then what is the cause for this? Oh, what is the cause for that? And we trace the thoughts back to try to get at the root, at the subtle experience that keeps fueling it. And the simile that's given is just like a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And then he would stand. And then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And then he would sit. Then he might consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And then he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture a posture that was subtler. So, for example, imagine that you were having a strong scenario of anger and fury, maybe revenge. And your thoughts just keep going. This person said this to me. I'm going to say this back. I'm going to get them this way, and I'm going to get them that way. Okay, it's an extremely unwholesome thought. Maybe you never had this. But imagine it. You can say, okay, why am I? What's the cause of this? Oh, there's hatred. That's the state that is fueling it. Anger, hatred. Okay, so you see, oh, that's an unwholesome state. That's hurts, you know, that's suffering. And then and you let the mind calm a little bit, because now at least you're not caught in the revenge, cruel thoughts. Now you're just feeling the state of anger, the state of hatred. And then you let it settle a little bit more, and you realize, what's going on here? What's the root of this hatred? Oh, this hatred is because I was insulted. And you can say, oh, what's going on there? Oh, there was the self was threatened. You know, this conceit was threatened. This self-concept was threatened. And then what's going on there? There was disappointment. I wanted something. Can I be with this state of not getting what I want? It's painful, but can I be with that? And we say, what's the cause of that? Wanting. Okay, so now we're in the realm of desire. And then we see that what were we really wanting? Well, actually what we were wanting was approval. We were wanting the person to like us, to appreciate us, to value and to like what we did. And we didn't get that. And so we were hurt. Oh, there's hurt. Can we be with the hurt? And then we follow it to the sadness. Then we follow it to this sense of just this little sense of insecurity, a subtle, tender place of insecurity that just wanted to be appreciated. As simple as that. And so we trace, and then we can see this subtle formation of self. And we see that what's underlying that? Oh, that's that craving for becoming, that craving for existence that Phil spoke about last night. It's a root, a craving, deeply, deeply conditioned. And so we went from the coarsest of revenge fantasies to just sensing this root of craving for existence, and could see how the emotions and the root tendencies, the mental states and emotions and the thought formations all get circled and intertwined and entangled. And little by little, we tease them out gradually and progressively, as the Buddha said, stilling the thought formations of those thoughts, what they're formed out of. But even after we've done all that work, sometimes those distracting thoughts still arise. And so the last suggestion that the Buddha had was, then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. When, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he beats down, constrains, and crushes mind with mind, then any evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion are abandoned in him and subside. With the abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness, and concentrated. It's a strong one, isn't it? We don't start there. That's the last. That's after everything else hasn't worked or has only brought us so far. But I think it is important sometimes to just say no and to actually mean it. To be able to say no to your own mind and to mean it. to be able to set some boundaries to your own thoughts. They shouldn't be aggressive. I think sometimes boundary setting is a compassionate and wise action. We know that with children. And sometimes our minds are like children, and we can set some clear and some wise boundaries that basically are coming out of compassion and wisdom for ourselves. Sometimes we have to take a stand for our own well-being. And this strong resolve, this determination to say, no, I will not entertain or indulge those unwholesome thoughts, not 1 second longer. And if we say that to ourselves and we mean it, I believe our minds will respond. I had this experience once or twice. This isn't the step that you usually use because, quite frankly, one of the first four almost always work. So you rarely have to get to this one. But I think at some point in every meditator's career, they've tried all these other four, and there's one thought that is still just continues to arise. Well, there was one aversive thought that kept arising on this retreat. And this was some years ago, and I just was fed up with it. I had tried everything. I had seen it. I had understood it. But the condition, every time that condition arose, of course it was something that somebody else did, right? Because if it was anything that I had control over, I would have fixed it. But clearly it was something I didn't have any control over. And so it would arise periodically. And then this familiar aversive response would arise. And I just thought, this is so useless. It's absolutely useless. And I used this and I remembered how effective it was because I saw that aversive thought arise and I just stopped. I was walking when it arose. And I just stopped and I said, no, I've seen where that goes. I've worked with it this way and that way. I know it inside and out. I know that aversive thought and there is no hope for anything good to come from it. There's just not. No good resolution is going to come. No great wisdom is going to come. I'm only going to suffer. So I said, no. Then I started to walk again. And I think I got 2 or 3 steps. And that thought came back. And so I put my foot down. No. And this time I said no with this energy of, I didn't quite press my tongue against the roof of my mouth, beating down, constraining mind with mind, but that was the feeling. It wasn't the physical experience. It was with that determination that I had had enough of it. I'd had enough. And I said no with him and actually really meant it. And I stood there a moment. Then I continued to walk. And I can't tell you how many dozens of times I had had that aversive thought when that particular trigger would arise. And it didn't return. I would see the trigger and then I would see a surprise like, wow, that was interesting. That familiar pattern didn't re-arise. It was like it didn't dare. And sometimes we have to be that strong. Sometimes, after we've done the wisdom, after we've seen the danger, after we've replaced it, after we've done everything else, sometimes we have to be that determined and let ourselves say no to certain things. This is likened to a strong man crushing a weaker one, which is again another violent image. But I like to think of it as the strength of wisdom crushing the unwholesome conditioning. And then the discourse says, this bhikkhu then is called a master of the courses of thought. He will think whatever thought he wishes to think, and he will not think any thought he does not wish to think. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. It's a happy ending to this discourse. After all that work, it at least has a nice happy ending. But isn't this intriguing, that with the complete penetration of conceit? Why conceit? Why do we have to penetrate conceit? This is a whole discourse on thoughts. Well, have you looked at your thoughts? What are they about? How many of your thoughts were actually about yourself? What you did, what you're doing, or what you will do? What you want, what you don't want? What you believe, what you don't believe? How you think things should be. So much of our thought is just about ourselves. Comparing, conceit. Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj said, "Reality is not the result of a process. It is an explosion. It is definitely beyond the mind, but all you can do is to know your mind well. Not that the mind will help you, but by knowing your mind, you may avoid your mind disabling you. You have to be very alert, or else your mind will play false with you. It is like watching a thief. Not that you expect anything from the thief, but you do not want to be robbed. In the same way, you give a lot of attention to the mind without expecting anything from it." So we investigate our thoughts. And this investigation invites us to glimpse how our thoughts and our thinking might be fueling this concept of self. And we'll see how thoughts feed on the mental stories that we weave. How, in fact, self is nothing other than a thought. All this protecting of self is just protecting a thought. In this way, overcoming distracting thoughts is so much more than just learning to calm a busy mind. It's more than an approach to concentration. It leads, in fact, to the most liberating of insights. Clearly seeing how thoughts operate is going to produce this insight into not self, into emptiness, and the experience of the fetters being flung off, the fetters being abandoned. Liberation, freedom will be realized. So here in this discourse, we have a gradual approach, but it is a gradual approach to the full path of tranquility and insight. A practical path that leads to the end of suffering.